You are listening to FinOps Today, a podcast from Ramp, where the world's most innovative finance leaders share what's on their agenda. Here's your host, Ramp's own head of finance and capital markets, Alex Song.
Hi there. Welcome to FinOps Today. On this week's episode, we're speaking with Jeannie DeGuzman, CFO of 1Password. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I'm super excited to be here.
That's great. How are you today?
I'm doing really well. Most people have heard that we had just a giant Series C fundraise that we announced a couple of weeks ago. So it's just been go, 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 and a lot of excitement. And so last week, we actually were able to have our virtual kickoff. And so this week, things are finally calming down a little bit where we can actually get some work done. So I'm feeling really great, really energized. And it's just a great way to start the year.
That's awesome. Congratulations. Congratulations on the fundraise. That sounds super exciting.
Thank you.
We're going through some similar motions here at Ramp. We have a pretty intense and fairly complicated balance sheet. So we're constantly managing, you know, equity versus debt capital, how we structure that. And so that is part of my job and so part of the fun. So going through some of the same motions, I'm sure that you're very familiar with.
Yeah, it's a lot of work on finance teams for sure when you're going through the diligence and at the same time you're trying to scale an organization. So it's kind of like an extra thing you have to worry about at a very busy time, but it's so exciting and so rewarding. And just the love that you feel after the announcement, it's honestly, you know, priceless, that feeling. And so I know the teams right now are feeling super jazzed about all the work they've put in. So we feel the pain, but I think the reward after it is so, so worth it.
That's stellar. I'd actually love to talk about fundraising a little bit later on in this podcast. I think that's going to be an area that's going to be pretty interesting to our listeners. But maybe just to back up a little bit, would you mind just telling us a little bit more about 1Password, what your company does, products, customers, et cetera?
Yeah, absolutely. So 1Password, we're actually headquartered here in Canada. I'm based out of Toronto myself. We've been around for about 15, 16 years now, and our roots are a consumer product. And, you know, we started off as a password manager, and that's kind of what a lot of consumers know us as. But we've evolved now into becoming a security company that serves both consumers and businesses. And so about 6 years ago, we had actually noticed that a bunch of our customers were bringing our product to work. And then we thought, hey, like, this could be a business product. And so we made that change in that evolution. And so since then, our vision has really grown. And one of the things that we introduced to everybody over the whole Series C and the investment that we had was this whole idea about human-centric security. So while we were kind of a pure password manager at the very inception of our company, we've really evolved to kind of being the company that really cares about security and about, you know, our whole mantra is human-centric security. And so the way I could kind of explain it in maybe more simple or layman terms is we really think that everyone's lives should be in 1Password. And this is something that, you know, we didn't necessarily just coin ourselves, but as we talk to our customers through all of the customer meetings and just random people, honestly, if I'm wearing a 1Password shirt showing up at a hotel saying, hey, my whole life is in 1Password, we're actually hearing that. And that really resonated with us. And I think, you know, what our product does today, it really kind of merges security with productivity. And so there's so many breaches online right now, and everybody knows this. They're at an all-time high. They're only growing. And so what do companies want to do? They want to protect their people. And, you know, sometimes that can be quite clunky. And so our whole thing is, let's take that clunkiness away. Let's not let people have to make a sacrifice between one of those two things. And so that's what we're kind of built on. And because of our consumer roots, we're able to do that because as a consumer, no one's telling you you have to use a product. You're choosing to use the product because it's beautiful and it's easy and you love it. And so that's kind of what's helping us get to all the businesses and say, hey, we're going to remove that friction. And so that's kind of the idea of the human-centric security. That's our vision for the future. So that's kind of like the really TLDR version of what we do.
Are you able to share with us how much of your business is consumer versus enterprise these days?
I can just give you like a very high level, like we don't share a lot of specifics, but you can read about this in the media. So I'm going to tell you that like today, after 5-6 years of being in B2B, it's greater than 50% of our annual recurring revenue now.
Any interesting nuggets or rules of thumb when dealing with selling to businesses versus consumers? Any differences in the product, considerations, et cetera?
Well, I can give you kind of the story of like how we've actually had to change and like why we even took a round to begin with, because we were bootstrapped for the first 15 years of our existence. And so, you know, Jeff Shiner, our CEO, he, you know, we didn't need the money. So we never really looked to bring on funding. But then as we introduced B2B, we didn't have a sales team. There was no marketing team. There was no finance team. You know, it was content people and developers and founders. And it was like, you know, like there were none of these other teams there. And so he thought, wait a second, if we're doing this well without these teams, like imagine what we need to do. And so the whole business model changed once we took the Series A, because he had Excel come in and basically give advice, like here's how you build sales and here's how you build marketing. It sounds pretty silly, but to sell to B2B, like having a sales team is pretty awesome. And having marketing teams are pretty awesome. We didn't have those 1.5 years ago. Our CMO just joined us 8 months ago, in fact. And so I would say the whole business and the whole company has completely changed the way it looks because we're trying to capitalize on B2B. And I would say that one of the things that, you know, is really endearing about 1Password is they had a very close-knit community. You know, we've changed our website a little bit and updated a little bit to be a little bit more polished. You know, there's different messaging you have to consider for both sides. And so the marketing teams have to be clever. How are we not going to lose what got us here, but also cater to the different buyer profiles that we have to sell to now? And so we definitely are organizing ourselves a lot differently than we did in the past. It's unified voice, but, you know, different teams are dedicated to kind of the B2B and B2C.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. If you only knew how much time we spent agonizing over, you know, stuff like this as well. It's interesting. I mean, building a business, you know, making sure you're in front of the customers, making sure you have a compelling sales pitch, value proposition, et cetera, that really resonates with me. Just to back up a little bit, Jeannie, I'd love to hear a little bit about your personal background, how you got into finance, how you got into your current CFO position.
Okay. I'm going to tell you from when I was back at school. It's the first time that I'll probably saying this in a very public setting. So if my parents ever get a hold of this, they're probably going to be livid. So I didn't think I was going to be an accountant or in finance at all. I didn't know what I wanted to do. In university, I majored in math and then took a couple minors in East Asian studies and geography. I was all over the place. So at the end, I said, I don't know what I'm going to do here. Luckily, I got into a program. I did my MBA. Through there, I met a couple people and they said, hey, you've got most of the classes for accounting. Why don't you just take the exams? It's not that hard. And you can just become an accountant. I'm like, okay, sure. So I ended up doing my MBA, just randomly, luckily meeting these people. They convinced me to go the CA in Canada, the chartered accountant route at the time, equivalent to the CPA. And so because I was working at a company that dealt with all the big four, I had connections there because I'll tell you, my GPA was not going to get me to these places. So I was lucky to have the big four accessible to me. I just ended up at KPMG and that's kind of how it happened. I had no clue before that this was going to ever happen in my life. So I ended up doing my whole audit thing at KPMG. Luckily for me, I attribute a lot of this to just kind of like perfect timing. I happened to join KPMG here in Toronto at a time where they were just about to build the Korean practice. And because I'm fluent in Korean and all the expats, you know, the CFOs were all expats, they really needed somebody who could speak. And so I ended up helping build that practice here in Toronto, which was really a special opportunity, I think. I think most people going through that program are like, oh, it's really a grind. But I got a lot of special treatment because of that. So it was a great 4 years. How did I get into tech from that was I told a partner, I said, listen, I don't want to be a partner here. I don't want to. And he said, hey, I know a guy who's hiring. And so I ended up at OpenText. So, you know, Canada's biggest software company. And I started off there in corporate accounting. I moved to corporate finance and treasury and kind of did a year and a half in each of those functions and thought it was like really great, huge company, learned all the things I needed to learn there. But, you know, for me, I was like really a hands-on, like I felt like I was a builder. And so I you know, ended up at Blue Cat here in Toronto as well. And through somebody I had met at OpenText. And so that was the first time I got to build like a real finance team from ground up. And it was like the best experience to be able to do that. And that's where I thought like, this is my niche. This is where I'm really good at being able to build at a company that needed that, you know, to scale. And so from there, I actually ended up meeting Excel through a mutual friend. And then they were like, hey, 1Password is a great opportunity. I met the founders, I met the CEO, fell in love, and the rest is history.
And when you joined 1Password, was there already a finance team or did you also have to build it from the ground up? What was the infrastructure like these days or maybe lack thereof?
Yeah, I, you know, there was a team. There was a founder, Sarah, and there was one other individual, and they were the team. And not only were they finance, they were HR. And basically everything, all back office functions, those two individuals did. So there was a very small team, but there was a lot of building we had to do for sure. I mean, the company was already about 180 people then. So it wasn't a 25 person company. So there was a lot of building for sure. So I would say that, you know, 2 years ago, just over 2 years ago when I came in, that was when the real building really happened. I could give you some examples of, like, I think a lot of this might resonate, you know, and this is perfectly normal for companies this stage. I mean, we didn't have an ERP system. We were working on QuickBooks, you know, and QuickBooks was on somebody's laptop. It wasn't a cloud QuickBooks where I could go and access it. You know, we were dealing in a global environment. We didn't have global banking. And so we were dealing with FX and things like that. Like, payroll was very hard. It was a one person show, and keeping track of HR records and things like that was just needed to happen. So we had to bring in a lot of systems in the first year, and we had to do a lot of structural things like looking at our legal entities and making sure they were set up properly. So a lot of basics happened in those first 2 years.
How was the building the finance team? How was it different the first time you did it and versus the second time you did it?
Yeah, the first time I did it, I had more people to start with. So there was at least five people that I inherited the first time. Mm. And it's a little different because the first time I did it, I would say the type of product, the type of company I was working at was large enterprise. So big chunky deals, like, it is different when you have the volume that we have here at 1Password because we have consumer and B2B, right? And so there's just a difference. Like, it might be the same. It could be the same revenues. It could be the same amount of expenses, but your volumes are just, like, different. And so here, coming to this company and only having two people and growing at the rate we were growing, you know, it was clear to me that we needed to build that team really, really fast. And so because there was such a wide array of things we needed to do, so even things like benefits, like I joke with the founders today. Today it's funny. And I say, like, you know, I go and look at my employment contract and it's like, you will get benefits once you put them into place. And so, you know, things like that had to be done. Whereas the other company, benefits existed, right? So, like, I just had to, like, make it better. This was like a real scale up. And so when I was building the team at 1Password, for me, I looked for people that I knew could consume a lot of different things. Because there was just an array of things that we needed to do. I needed to bring the people in, and you know, we didn't have a budget. Like, we had to create a budget and say, like, how much can we spend on folks to get to, you know, point B that we're trying to get to. And so we were still pretty lean at the beginning, like trying to operate really in a lean way, because I had to figure out what position we were in to, like, invest. So the types of people I brought on were the ones that I knew that could just get through, like, you know, I always use this example, like, if we need to go dig holes, they can go dig holes. And if we need to go set up benefits, we're going to go set up benefits, even though they're finance people. So really nimble and flexible people was who I was looking for. And that's kind of, I built that team pretty quickly. I started talking to people before I even started here because I knew I needed them on, like, ASAP.
That's so interesting. This is a question that I ask every one of my guests. I'd love to know, of those first few folks that you hired, it sounds like you were optimizing for strong generalists, right? Folks who had a lot of grit, worked hard. What specific functions do they serve? Years of experience? If one of our listeners, for example, was building out his or her first finance team, what are the sort of candidates that they should be looking for? You know, Big Four accounting, or maybe Wall Street, or, you know, any sort of tips or guidelines around, let's say, maybe your first three or four hires. You know, who were they? What were they like?
Yeah. So I would say, like, one way to put it is one of my very first hires was my right hand through the last 2 years. And she came from a Big Four, and I knew her from a Big Four. So I knew the kind of personality she was. Let's say today she's our senior director of finance ops. So she's somebody who I knew would be able to be super operational, but also really understand the backbone of financial audits, because we needed that. And we need to understand the GL. And so for me, what you talked about around grit and resilience, that was, like, number one for me, because you need somebody who's able to just consume a lot and just be okay not getting everything 100% perfect the first time around, and just kind of be able to move on and do the next thing and content switch really quickly. So like that individual today is our finance ops person because I know that's what she's good at. I hired an array of people. So I hired people that had some industry experience, and I hired people that didn't come from the big four, but had accounting backgrounds and that had, you know, close experience because you kind of needed that. And so I tried to pick those people that with, like, first of all, with the grit and resilience, but also the ability, like they have a special background, but they can apply it to like many other things. I think that a big four background is really great, especially if you know that the GL is a mess. You need just somebody who can come in and like quickly sort through things and make some decisions and have that, you know, professional judgment that you can rely and trust on. I do think somebody they don't have to be a CPA or anything like that, but if they've had transactional experience, and by transactional, I mean AP or AR, like, you know, like being able to understand invoicing and billing, that I think is really important as well. And then FP&A for sure, like bringing somebody in with an FP&A background has always been like one of my top three hires.
Very interesting. How about today? What does the team look like? How big is the team? What are the different functions? And actually, what would be helpful is, what's the headcount relative to the overall headcount?
Mm-hmm. So we're today, the team ended last year at about 30 out of about 550 headcount. So we're a team of 30. This year, we'll end the year at about 60 with about a headcount of about 1,000. So we are linearly doubling.
And is the 3%, so it comes out to around 3%. Is that a good target? Is that a good heuristic? How are you arriving at that number?
So it really depends. Like, you know, I think of like the cost as a percentage of revenue. I think we're right there where we should be, because like you could have lots of heads, but if you don't have the right seniority in heads, it's not necessarily helping you, right? So from a percentage of revenue perspective, I think we're going to be right in the right place. But I also wanted to caveat that this year, despite doubling, included in that headcount are also, you know, a group of data analysts, for example, that are not necessarily always typical finance. But right now, because we're cleaning up our data, you know, they are sitting under finance because we care about the rigor of the numbers and we thought that it made sense for this year. So it's not just pure finance that we're going into. So we are getting some efficiencies there. The way we are currently organizing ourselves is we have the controllership group, and actually our VP controller just joined us less than a month ago. We have our FP&A group, VP of FP&A just joined late last year. And then I have finance ops. And then within those teams, you know, I'm very lucky under ops, we also have a systems person dedicated to finance systems and NetSuite. Under FP&A, we're going to be having the data team. And then we will also have, you know, like a dedicated revenue team, for example, because we have, you know, rev rec issues and we're US GAAP. So we have to follow 606 and all of that. So this year is definitely a getting to a best in class org chart, but you can tell that even my two VPs that maybe I should have hired earlier, they just joined us recently. And this is 2 years in already. And sometimes you don't have the luxury of having those headcounts immediately, right? And so you have to, yesterday, I wanted the nimble and I wanted everyone to be able to do anything. Now what I want is, because we've gotten over that hump, is those people are super important still. They're going to be on like very specific tasks and projects that they need to do. But what I'm telling the team is like, we don't have to be the jack of all trades anymore. You don't have to be that person anymore. I know it's tiring. We're tired. We're now going to focus and make your scope more consumable for you. We're going to try to now achieve some work-life balance because 2 years have been a grind. And because of that, you can let go of some of the things that maybe you're not supposed to do in your typical role. And we're going to bring those people to do it. So we are scoping a lot differently today than I was 2 years ago, for sure.
There you go. That's fascinating. We're here at Ramp. I think we're probably a little bit closer to the first half of that than sure. than the latter half. But obviously, it's something that I'm looking forward to as I think about building out the team. What about relative headcount? It sounds like you've got the controllership, the accounting function, you've got FP&A, which it sounds like also includes a data science team, and then you have financial operations, right? And across those three areas, what is, you know, maybe more headcount versus less? And, you know, how does that feel to you?
Yeah, so our controllership team is big because under controllership is also tax. And there's a lot of facets under controllership. So you have tax, you have revenue, you have like the payroll, that, and you have the GL team. So they're bigger. And then our FP&A team is quite bigger because, again, we're B2B and B2C, so we're organizing ourselves to have the experts in each of those streams. They're not, you can't model them the same. And so you need different people overseeing it. And because we have the volume thing and we're growing so quickly, like our models need to be, you know, you can't have one person owning all of it. So the FP&A team is growing quite a bit. The finance ops team is kind of new. So like relative to itself, it's quite big, but I would say they're the smaller team. We probably will have 5 people on that team though, which is still quite sizable, I think.
And what does that team do?
Yeah, that's a good question. What do they do today and what should they do tomorrow? So I'll give you some examples of what finance ops does. So first of all, the easy one to kind of point out is finance systems. It sits under there. And so finance systems, anything from NetSuite, rolling out a new commissions tool, working on integrations between those things, that's for sure sits under there. The other interesting things that a finance ops team does is, so you have a commission system, great, but what about the commissions plan? Who's going to help develop a commissions plan that makes sense from a finance perspective and liaise with the go-to-market team to make sure that it can get implemented properly? And so they're going to work towards a process to say, here's how the commissions process is going to work at 1Password. And then our finance ops person will tell controllership, okay, this is what's going to happen. Like, you're going to do the recs and kind of coordinate and orchestrate a project like that. We're actually going to start looking at some internal controls. And if that becomes a massive project for us, then finance ops is going to be project managing that for us. If I have a big project across the finance org, I will have finance ops take a look at that. They also administer and deal with anything to do with equity today. So they administer equity plan. And then for sure, when we're doing any kind of fundraising or due diligence kind of efforts, they're quarterbacking the project management around that.
It's a very interesting group because it cuts across a lot of different functions, right? I think traditionally, what you might think of, for example, the, you know, sales commissions and whatnot, you know, you think that you know, may actually sit inside, or maybe some companies may put that in FP&A, right? Goes mm-hmm. into the budgeting exercise, the planning exercise, et cetera. So it's interesting that it's a part of a separate group.
Yeah, and they work very closely together because we always have the budget for it. But to actually help come up with plan documents and, you know, how is that the approval flows going to happen? Who's going to make sure we're accruing for it properly and then it gets paid properly? It's just being the quarterback for all of those things. And it's because we're building. Remember, we didn't have a sales team a year and a half ago. So this is first time commissions plans for us. And so it's like that building stage. They won't always own it. They will eventually pass it off. So there's a lot of special projects, especially at the building stage. You really want someone who can be the person that can kind of bring people together because the FP&A is busy building FP&A stuff that never existed. And so I think in a Series A, Series B stage, it's a very, if you're able to have that role, it's a luxury to have.
In terms of financial operations, actually, I'd like to know, broadly speaking across the finance team and the finance function, what are some of the bottlenecks that you currently see? Areas of frustration, areas that you think you might do a better job of scaling or automating? You know, I think usually what winds up happening is a lot of folks talk about all the successes and the milestones and whatnot. One of the things I'd like to ask my guests is, you know, what are your top one or two most frustrating things about their day-to-day?
I feel more frustrated for my team. They must feel incredibly frustrated, but it's because at the beginning, when you don't have enough people, you find ways to get things done. And like I said, not 100%. So a lot of things end up after a year or two of cleanup, like manual things are happening. And you look around, you're like, oh my God, everything is so manual. We didn't think about automating stuff. We just needed NetSuite in and it needed to be working. But like, did we optimize it? And so I think one of the things that frustrates people is just all of that manual work that somehow ends up piling onto your plate because we didn't start by trying to automate these things. So this is true of almost any team that I've worked out. And it's today we're thinking about what are we going to automate so that people don't have to spend a weekend VLOOKUPing 2 giant spreadsheets for stuff. You know, like how are we going to automate credit card reconciliations? It's like literally the worst task at any company is trying to figure out credit card reconciliations for like 12 credit cards. And I found out that somebody was doing 8 hours of work on a weekend because they just needed time to manually match stuff. And so I would say that the most frustrating thing that ends up piling on in finance during a cleanup or during like early stages is that manual stuff. it starts off very innocently, right? It'll be, hey, we only have 10 people, so let's just do expense reports in Excel. Cool, makes sense. You wake up one day and you're 100 people doing Excel-based expense reports, and it's no longer fun. Like, it's no longer 2 hours of your day. It's now 3 days. And you think, like, why didn't I take care of this earlier? And so I think that's one of the things that we really need to focus on as finance folks. Like, every time I go back and I think, what could I have done better? It's like, I could have automated from the beginning a little better.
Definitely. I mean, you're just accruing, you know, technical debt, right? Yeah. So to speak, you know, something that just accrues over time. And there's just insidious creep, I suppose. And I'm curious, like, whose job is it to kind of audit that and to revisit that every month or every quarter or every year? You know, does that function fall on a single person or like a single stakeholder, or does that fall on you? Like, who can come in and really say, okay, I've identified 7 things, right? We're going to automate this stuff and our deadline is in 2 months. Right? Who's empowered to do that?
So everybody, every single person on the team, I think, has to own a manual process and put their hand up and say, I know how to make this better. I myself own, you know, enabling the teams to feel like there are resources and there are options available, and that, and when they speak up, there is actually something we can do about it. And so that's something that with the teams, like, I haven't said explicitly until maybe last week, saying, hey, if you're doing something that you hate, raise your hand up, because we can do something about it. There's got to be a better way to do it. And so I do think it's on each person, because especially we're remote too. So I don't actually watch somebody's screen and see what they do all day. I had no clue somebody was working Saturdays at least once a month to do this thing for 8 hours. And it was brought up to me and I said, well, why didn't they say anything? And then, you know, when you reflect, it's like, well, they must not have felt like they could have, or they must not have felt like there was hope or there was like a solution to it. And so that's something we're working on internally, is to say, like, no, we want to automate. We want to make your lives easier. We don't want you to be doing that kind of work. And I think one of the first indicators of us committing to that was to actually bring on a systems person full time and say, this person knows how to automate everything. So give her the list, because she will do it over time. And so now we're building a roadmap for all of that.
Yeah, that sounds great. We need someone like that. Yeah, Ramp.
You are listening to FinOps Today, a podcast from Ramp.
This next section is this is my favorite section. I really want to call this the lightning round, but it's really not the lightning round, because we're going to go very granular into some very, very specific details. And a lot of this stuff is just stuff I'm just super, super interested in. Topic number one, okay? In-house versus outsourced resources when it comes to things like tax and bookkeeping and whatnot. What is the right time to move stuff in-house? Earlier today, you mentioned, right, you have in-house tax now, right? So, you know, when did you make that decision? What is right to keep internal versus external?
Yeah. So I'll tell you that one of my earliest hires was a tax person, by the way. I am somebody who likes to bring tax in, because I think they're largely ignored for a little bit too long. For me, it's a balance. There's always going to be a mix of in-house and outsourcing. And it's really just going to be a value ROI kind of calculation. How long does it take somebody in-house? How long does it take somebody, you know, externally? Is there other things this person could be doing internally that brings more value to the org? And we'll do that for every single time we want to outsource something. And I am a big fan of outsourcing when it makes total sense. Because if it doesn't have to be internally and I have, you know, 300 other things they could be doing, you know, I'm going to prioritize those 300 other things that have to be done in-house.
Are there any functions that are easier to outsource?
I would say that, for example, when you have smaller, you know, on the tax side, you know, corporate, I usually like being in-house with some, you know, with a review from externals. But let's say you have a small entity and it's just annoying. Like, I happily give somebody all of that accounting and say, just give me the entries to book on my side. I don't need to know the details. It's immaterial. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's worth having a person. So that, you know, very kind of immaterial pieces definitely are worth outsourcing, because the effort is too big. What's the hardest thing to outsource, I think, is anything operational. So anything where you require cross-business unit collaboration, it's much better because to do it in-house, because you have those relationships and you're building that trust between people and you get to keep kind of that legacy knowledge and you understand how it's built. I think that's the hardest piece to kind of outsource to a consultant.
Yeah, that's a great answer. It's something that we think about, you know, every day, just because we still don't have a massive finance team yet, right? And so we rely on external resources quite a bit. Topic area number two, real estate. Okay, we're all working remote. A lot of us are very distributed. Some of us still have offices to go to. Some of us don't. Who owns that at 1Password? Is someone out there scoping out commercial real estate? Is your utilization 10%, 50%, or 80% right now? How do you make sure that the office space is out there and it's being utilized, or maybe it's not utilized? How are you thinking about real estate right now?
Yeah, it's interesting. We've been remote since inception. When I joined, we actually had a tiny office in Toronto where you could come. It was never mandated. And we have another small office out in St. Thomas here where the support team likes to be together. We don't mandate it at all. We are a remote first company. However, we brought on a lot of people over the last year, and a lot of those people have never worked remote before. And, you know, it might have been a teensy bit easier because the whole world was working remotely. But now I think people are craving a lot of that kind of social, that in-person time. And so while I don't think, you know, certainly 1Password will never go back to a full-time in-office kind of company, we are certainly considering, should we have some spaces made available so that people in regions can get together for meetings here and there? And I would say that I was on a bunch of tours here in Toronto, at least, and probably until maybe last month, I would have been the one kind of sourcing those spaces. And, you know, I've seen it done under finance, but, you know, we just hired a chief people officer who happened to head real estate at one of her previous roles. So, Yes. Hey, like, I think there's nobody better than to own that. So, you know, it can be in operations, it can be in finance, it can be, you know, a people officer. But for 1Password specifically, it's not a rush because that hasn't been part of our culture, but we do want to make sure the employees get what they need. So we are looking to, you know, investigate that a little bit more.
Got it. Area number three, audits. Yeah, everyone's favorite topic. Any best practices, pitfalls, how you guys have been able to navigate some of this in the past?
Yeah, so we've actually completed an audit. We're a private company in Canada, so you could get away with some more lenient standards. But we actually bit the bullet last year and said, hey, we're going to go US GAAP, full-blown audit and all of that. And we did it. And part of it was to challenge ourselves to say, like, hey, let's get the books into shape and let's make sure somebody looks at it and says that, yeah, you did a great job. And so it was something that the team and I discussed and thought, yeah, we might as well. We were converting from cash basis of accounting to accrual. And so we're like, let's just do it all and get it over with. And let's get all of the misstatements, if there were any, you know, open now so we can, you know, fix it. Like, I'd rather fix it as a private company where nobody's really wanting audited statements and then, you know, have somebody point out, like, here's where you need to address things. I mean, the team did a great job. We didn't really have to fix anything, but that was kind of the intent. If you can and have the ability to do so, I would recommend it doing earlier than later. It's a great way to figure out where you need to improve and build those relationships with the auditors. And they're an awesome help, you know, when you're trying to figure out accounting throughout the year. And I think they're a resource from that perspective.
Last and final topic. I know we've been moving from topic to topic quite quickly. Last and final topic, I mentioned that we would talk about it, which is fundraising. You guys closed a pretty large funding round. What was that like, specifically speaking as the CFO or the finance team? How much work was there? Was there a lot of work on the front end, on the back end? You know, what are some maybe pain points, right? I mean, again, this is an area where all we see are the headlines and people are happy. Everyone's congratulating each other. Let's talk about, you know, what was frustrating, or, you know, what were some of the bottlenecks there?
Yeah, I would say that with any due diligence, you know, the painful part is it's not the selling, it's not the talking to investors and telling your story. That's all the fun stuff. But the painful part is the back office piece, right? You know, depending on who you get as legal counsel for the investors, they're going to ask some tough questions. They may go back and ask you questions about things that happened when you didn't exist at the company. And so kind of going and figuring out the answers to those questions, or like the documents that...
By the way, who's asking those questions?
So it would be basically the legal counsel for the investors.
I see. Yep.
It's generally, and then at the investors, they'll have their head person that's also asking questions from the business side. So you have like the legal diligence, and then you have kind of like the business diligence. But legal diligence, it gets into the weeds. It's like, we need this very specific contract, or we need this very specific line in your, you know, equity plan, or what have you. And so that's kind of the not fun part, because it's like, you're just digging, you're just, you don't feel like it's value add necessarily. You know, it's going to result in a great result, but that's not the fun stuff. And that's where, you know, it's late nights because you're doing it as your second job. Now you have a full-time job, you're doing this on top. And so that's where, you know, the team really needs to get together and kind of like, you know, rah-rah together, because it can get long for sure. And I think, you know, it can be very disorganized. So keeping organized is one of the most difficult things during diligence.
And do you have a dedicated investor relations function or professional? Okay.
Not yet, but the individual in finance ops was my right hand there, because she had so much exposure to all of the other business units. She kind of knew like, where would I go for this customer contract, or where would I go for these terms and conditions? Like, she had that knowledge. And so it was really easy for her to play that role.
Yeah, that's great. What about, and this is something that I don't know how many people think about ever, but what about treasury operations? Who's the guy who's picking up the phone and giving out, you know, wiring details and reconciling, you know, the cap table and, you know, cash in, cash out? Is that someone on one of the teams that you listed before?
For sure. The team that I listed before exists today. They didn't exist during due diligence just 2 months ago, right? So it's the person that's finance ops today was everything. Everyone reported into her. So she is the main person, but we do have a treasury manager on our team. And that was something that was important to me, because that often gets lost in the mix. But I, you know, as a software company, you know, free cash flows and cash is kind of something that is very important. And, you know, we had a big project where we brought in global banking systems. And so we needed a dedicated person. So that person would be in charge of things like wires and confirming wire details and things like that, reconciling cash. And then finance ops would be the one coordinating our massive spreadsheet of like, where's all the cash coming and going. And so definitely a group effort there, but I would rely on my treasury person for treasury things, but my finance ops person to project manage it all.
I just want to say, wow, you know, I really appreciate, we covered 4 pretty hefty topics pretty quickly, you know, all very, very informative. I find that, you know, a lot of the comments that you made definitely resonate with some of the stuff we've been experiencing here at RAM, you know, in the past couple of months. Maybe switching gears a little bit and kind of taking more of a 30,000 foot view. 2022, what's going on? You know, what are you excited about? You know, what's on the horizon, either, you know, personally, professionally, the company, the markets, you know, do you have a view there? You know, what are some of the major things that maybe you're excited about accomplishing this year?
Yeah, 2022 for 1Password is going to be a huge year. It's the year where I feel like we've done a lot of foundational building already. And this is where we optimize. From a finance perspective, we're going to optimize everything. So we have the right people in place. We started the year off with all the right people that we need to kind of perfect our craft here. And I think this is going to be the year for that. For 1Password, I mean, it's just incredible. We started the year with a huge announcement. People are so excited about us. We've got this vision that's resonating with lots of people. Everyone is just wanting to meet and talk about it. And so we're just really looking forward to kind of investing, you know, doubling our headcount, investing in the people, investing in the departments that need to optimize so that we can execute on this vision that everyone's so excited about. I think that we're very fortunate. We announced, even in the current market conditions where a lot of people are getting a little nervous, but I think I'm, you know, super proud of being able to have a Series C despite those conditions. And I think that speaks volumes for kind of our business model. And so, you know, this is just going to be one big year of getting a lot of stuff done. We're just gaining momentum now. And we finally have like a full C-suite. And so personally, that makes me really happy. We're not, you know, building marketing this year. Marketing's already here and technology is already here. And so this is a big year for us. We're going to get a lot of stuff done.
That's phenomenal. Out of curiosity, any hiring internationally? Are you in the US? Are you in other countries? Or is it still, you know, vast majority in Canada?
No, actually, Canada and US are almost equal. And then we have about 40 to 50 folks in the UK. And then we have about 10 in the Netherlands right now. So the Netherlands, we acquired a company earlier last year, actually. And so those would be the four regions that we would actually hire out of. And so we're going to have, 500 plus roles that are being posted. So anyone who's in one of those regions can apply. Just tons of roles will be coming out.
Jeannie, this was great. Thanks so much for joining us. I know we covered a lot of topics. I personally found it to be extremely, extremely insightful. I know what I have to look forward to in the coming years. Hopefully I'm able to kind of follow in your footsteps. I would love one day to be leading, a 30-person or 50-person finance team. So really appreciate all the comments and all the insights from today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a lot of fun. I'm really excited because we're partners. Ramp and 1Password are partners, so it's even more exciting to be here.
Thanks for listening to this episode. If you enjoyed it, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows. It really helps to spread the word. Until next time, this is FinOps Today from Ramp.